Build a polished wardrobe that shows you stay you wherever you go with Mack Weldon. Use code MACK25 for 25% off your first order of $125 or more at MackWeldon.com. From the office to a first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They combine timeless style with modern performance materials to keep you looking good and feeling comfortable all day, no matter what's on today's agenda. Browse everything from shorts and polos to sweats and crews. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Welcome to Espresso Martini. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing good, Chris. Still a little tired this morning, or in at least the 30 minutes of morning I have left, but you know, we're good.
Well, gosh. Nearly. I mean, late afternoon, early evening, and I'm a bit knackered today. I don't know what it is. I think it's the weather or something. I feel a bit heady and a bit repressed for some reason.
Yeah.
A bit of pressure or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, we've had some funny old weather in the UK. As some may have witnessed on the news with the announcement of a general election coming up in the UK on American Independence Day of all days. So with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak covered in rainwater, and I have a horrible feeling for him at least, that image will come back to haunt him and may become a metaphor for this election.
Yeah.
We will see.
Well, that didn't. We didn't have this plan to discuss today. But I'm just like, it seems like there's like conflicting past statements of his that I've seen. You know, I haven't seen much of the coverage yesterday. I was busy with other stuff. But it seems like there's recent statements of his, like even arguably as of like the day before yesterday or like yesterday morning, indicating that he did not intend to have a general election this summer.
Yeah.
Like, so what, like, speculate with me here, what changed?
I don't know, because I've been listening to a few things trying to understand it myself, because apparently quite a few senior conservatives were just as kind of surprised as you and I are at the moment. My only suspicion could be, well, it's twofold. I was thinking about this morning on my walk. So it could be he's got some juicy alternative job offer that's happening some point later this year, and he had to make a decision.
Oh, that would be bleak.
Yeah, so that could be it. So it could be like, well, Mr. Sunak, if you want to join this, that, or the other organization,
yeah,
we'll need you by September or something.
Yeah,
that could be it. That could be it. Or it could be there was a threat of further Tory rebellion within the party, and another leadership contest potentially, because there've been quite a few of those. So yeah, it's an interesting one, because obviously the Conservatives just had a terrible defeat in local elections in the UK.
They've had a number of them over the last year, like one after the other, right?
Yeah, indeed. And so it's looking very bleak for the Conservative Party at the moment. And you know, and don't mistake my should we say it's like a bit somber about it, and serious. I'm trying to be impartial, because I'm not a fan of the current Conservative government. I haven't been a fan of the Conservative government at all. I put a lengthy list yesterday. I felt triggered, actually, when I heard the election. I had a bit of a rant on Twitter yesterday, just because there's so many things that have not been fantastic that just feel a lot worse than we were 10... No, when was it? 2010 was when David Cameron came in, and he came in with a mandate to fix broken Britain. And I don't know what's beyond broken, but Britain feels beyond broken currently. Mm. So whatever's beyond broken, please tell me. Knackered, I don't know, that might be a bit much, but you know, certainly Britain doesn't feel in the greatest of places right now. And I think Brexit, COVID, and obviously the war in Ukraine are key contributors to that feeling. So we will see what will happen. I feel optimistic there probably will be some sort of change of government.
Yeah, it seems that way from all indications.
It is. All the kind of right ingredients seem to be in the right place. I think I've been saying this before about, I think Labour very much needs Scotland, and Scotland at the moment seems to be going through some sort of political turmoil of its own with leadership changes at the SNP. Obviously, the local elections we've just talked about. So the thing is with elections, you know, things can change. We had this with Ed Miliband in 2015. There was a feeling of that Ed Miliband was inevitably going to take over as prime minister, and he didn't. And in fact, the Conservatives did very well. And I think part of that was driven by the David Cameron's commitment to a referendum on leaving the EU. So we'll see what happens, because also the other scary thing is with elections, usually it means the terrorism threat increases, because extremists on tend to want to influence things. So in 2017, I remember that year when it was Theresa May was up for election, we had the London Bridge attacks, which were around Borough Market. We had the Westminster Bridge attack, and we had the Manchester Arena bombing as well. I hope to God that we don't have anything equivalent of that during our election cycle here. Certainly 2019, the last election cycle, I don't recall anything as significant as that happening over that period. So we will see. We will see what happens with all of that. But yeah, so that's the skinny on the UK election at the moment.
Yeah. When is the date again? I think it's sooner than like pretty much everyone expected it to be. A lot sooner.
4th of July, American Independence Day.
Oh yeah, that's right. You said that at the.
They'll be getting our hot dogs out. Yeah. I'll be getting my hot dog out, and I don't know whatever American item's going to take to the election booth with me. I'll go and dress as Uncle Sam or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how I'm celebrating American independence this year.
All right. Well, yeah,
we'll see how that goes.
We'll get an answer to that question soon. I know it's been hanging over a lot of people's heads for a while.
It's been a big mystery in the UK. When's the next election? Because in theory, they could have strung it out till January of next year. And I think, like, when I spoke with Edward Lucas earlier this year, he felt it would be January next year. And I think most conservatives were hoping it'd be the autumn. And I think the school of thought was the longer they leave it, the better it might be for them, because this year has not been a good year for the Conservatives in the polls. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously not in the voting booth now. So we will see now if this gamble of Rishi Sunak will pay off.
Yeah.
Other than that, I have no idea why he decided to call it. It's as much a surprise to you, me, and many members of the Conservative Party at the moment. And I think many members of Labour too.
If there is some sort of intriguing reason as to why behind, I'm sure it'll come out.
Yeah.
Like you can't, some journalists will find out and report it eventually.
I don't know. Yeah. Could be anything. I mean, who knows? It might be something really catastrophic. It might not be. Maybe they just, I don't know. I can't think of what else it could be other than the sort of two reasons I stated there. Mm-hmm. Unless somebody internally just thought boldly that there's some weird ray of hope that we haven't seen. It could be, I don't know, maybe they've got some very deep, dark secret they've discovered about Sir Keir Starmer they might have. I don't know. I can't think of what it could be. Who knows? I can't believe somebody like Rishi Sunak or the party or his advisors would do it sort of on a whim. But you never know. They couldn't even plan for the weather, which was the thing that made me chuckle a little bit, because watching him soaked with rain, you would have thought somebody somewhere would have either thought, okay, well, I'll send Prime Minister Sunak out with somebody with an umbrella to stand next to him. Or they could have erected a gazebo or something. There are many things you can do to stop yourself from getting soaked in the rain. And the fact that they couldn't even organise that and left the front pages this morning with a picture of the Prime Minister soaked just strikes me as very poor planning. on their part. So we will see.
We will see.
So maybe there is no grand plan. Maybe it is all just maybe he rolled a dice that morning. I don't know, read his horoscope or shook the, what's that ball with the number 8 that tells you things?
Like the magic 8 ball that you shake it and it says like reply hazy or whatever. Yeah.
So maybe he shook that and it said, call the election now.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe like they like maybe they're down under number 10 somewhere. They just like chop off a chicken's head and then it runs around for a bit. And then if it falls on like a date, you know, that's when they decide when the election is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the only I think hole in that theory is they've got Larry the cat, haven't they? Who'd probably intervene with a headless chicken.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, that's true.
And Larry, according to his Twitter feed, he stayed in yesterday.
Nice. Yeah. Larry the cat is my eternal prime minister. He'll always be.
Yeah. I think he's the longest serving member of number 10 at the moment, but anyway. Oh, dear. So, yeah. So, moving away from British politics. Mm-hmm. So, today we are going to be looking at the death of the Iranian president. Then we're going to be looking at Israel and Iran espionage comparisons. And then we'll finish up with secret Hamas files that expose a mass surveillance campaign in Gaza. Then on Extra Shot, which is our Patreon-only show, we're going to be looking at reports of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau not taking the work of Canada's intelligence services seriously. Then we're going to be looking at Chinese research into brain-computer interfaces, which is getting into a very creepy territory. Then we're going to be looking at the FBI cutting ties with Russian informants. And if that's not enough, we'll be wrapping up looking at CIA funding of artworks during the Cold War. So to get access to Extra Shot, all you'll need to do is click on the link in the show notes. It will be available immediately when you click on that link, or you could directly go to patreon.com/secrets and spies. So Matt, I think this is the best topic for you, because you are kind of our in-house sort of Iran expert, and so I'd like to chat with you a bit about the Iranian president and get your thoughts. So you picked out a piece that kind of summarizes what happened over, was it last Sunday, wasn't it?
It was last Sunday. Yeah.
Yeah, the dramatic events of last weekend. So yeah, I'll let you kick off with that.
I want to preface this our discussion with here. So I have recorded another interview with our good friend of the pod, best friend of the pod, Philip Smythe. By the time this episode is out, that episode should be out as well. So if you're listening and haven't heard that yet, it should be the one in your feed right below this one.
And if you haven't listened, the question is A, why not? And B, there'll be questions at the end of this episode. But anyway.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, so over an hour, really great analysis, talk about the leadership dynamics in Iran right now and what it means for the succession planning for the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. Really good stuff there. So there's going to be way more about this specific topic in that episode. So definitely go check that out too. However, we have here an op-ed in the Washington Post from Jason Rezaian, who's a dual citizen, dual U.S. Iranian citizen who was held prison in Iran for a number of years.
He was. Yeah, it was after he was on a show of Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown. Yeah. And then I think almost immediately after that aired, he was arrested with his wife, I believe. And then his wife was released earlier, and then he was held for a good few years. And there was a lot of campaigning to get him out of Iran, and eventually he was lucky enough to be released.
Yeah. So here's a couple points from his op-ed. So the lack of immediate information about Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi's death and helicopter crash last Sunday has fueled wide speculation and conspiracy theories within the country, each reflecting poorly on the regime. Iranian state TV initially reported a, quote, hard landing before confirming Raisi and other officials' deaths. The delay in details led to various theories undermining the regime's credibility. Some speculated Israel's involvement, despite denials, reflecting fears of Israel's influence within Iran. Another theory suggested internal political rivalry, with suspicions falling on Khamenei's son, Mojtaba, now considered a likely candidate to succeed his father as supreme leader after Raisi's death, highlighting the regime's history of internal violence and competition. However, the most likely cause is the regime's infrastructural decay, resulting in dangerous travel conditions due to poor maintenance exacerbated by economic sanctions. I just want to make that point really clear here. resigned in this op-ed. He brings up a number of the conspiracy theories around Raisi's death that are floating around the country, not to suggest that any of them are true, but to say that, like, this is what Iranians are saying about it, which is honestly, like, we'd be doing the exact same thing here in this country right now, honestly, and it would drive me nuts. However, I am firmly on Team Fog here, like Occam's razor. Yeah, a helicopter was up where it shouldn't have been. It crashed. Stranger things have happened.
Yeah.
Just Iran's president happened to be on it. Anyway, I digress. The crash underscores Iran's broader issues, including high road and air accident rates, raising questions about the regime's competence and priorities. While Raisi's death may not lead to significant change due to the regime's deep entrenchment, it highlights ongoing issues and dissatisfaction among Iranians. In a regime that often attributes failures to divine will, the public wonders how the government will rationalize this event. President Raisi, linked to the mass execution of dissidents in the 1980s, will likely not be widely mourned. We can talk about that in a second. But his death alone is unlikely to destabilize the regime significantly. Chris, what did you think about it?
Yeah, well, I'm not one to wish ill on other people, but I personally do not feel that the death of President Raisi is a tragedy for humanity. You know, as you mentioned just a moment ago, he was responsible for the mass killing of political dissidents in the 1980s. So I'm not sure whether his death went up being a positive thing for Iran or not. And I'm not sure at the moment. Have they decided who's going to succeed him under the current system?
So Iran, in their system, they have a number of vice presidents. The first vice president, whose name escapes me off the top of my head right now, but I talk about this with Philip. He is right now interim president, and under their system, they'll have a new election in sometime in June.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
To fill that role for a number for like another 4-year term.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Well, yeah. On that day, the news broke. A few friends asked me what I thought about what had happened, and obviously, initially, my mind did wander down to assassination just for a moment. But ultimately, I felt that was unlikely, as there are easier ways to kill people than waiting for a target to get into a helicopter and fly through bad weather conditions. Also, if there were any device on the helicopter, it would likely be found by a subsequent investigation. And the only comparison I could think of was the downing of PAC-1 in the 1980s, which had the Pakistani president on board, and he was killed in a plane crash. And Fred Burton from the Department of State Security investigated that. I don't know if you know that one. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah. There's also the crash, a Polish Air Force transport crashed in. Was that in Smolensk? It was a high delegation visiting Russia and killed a whole bunch of Poland senior leaders.
Yeah. Was that found to be an act of sort of sabotage or?
No, I don't think that's ever been. I don't think it's ever been proven.
No. Because with PAC-1, the interesting thing with that one, the investigation did find in the end it was a suspicious can of Coke that had been in the cockpit, and apparently it had I call it a chemical weapon. I might be wrong here. So if Dan Kazita's out there, forgive me if I get this wrong. But it was some sort of kind of chemical weapon that went off at a certain certain altitude that incapacitated the pilots and caused it to crash. That's what Fred Burton concluded. And obviously they found that through, you know, what happens with a plane crash is usually they try and rebuild the aircraft and sort of look for what's missing. Then they look for, like they could find burn marks quite easy. It shouldn't be there, that are inconsistent with the type of crash that it looks like. So basically, if somebody did bump off the president in that way, it will probably be discovered through the subsequent investigation.
It's very hard, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's a huge political risk when bumping off heads of state. And I don't think, because who would be the culprit? So ultimately, I think, if there were anybody immediately who would be considering doing that, it would probably be the Israeli government. And I don't think that they would target a head of state. They would probably they would probably more likely target somebody more operationally important, like the leader of
the Quds Force. Or the Quds Force general who had the Syria, Lebanon, Gaza file that they killed in the airstrike a couple months ago. Yeah.
And they tend to do it in a more spectacular, obvious way, like a rocket attack or a bomb on a car or machine gunning people and or going into a hotel room and, you know, smothering someone, etc., which is, you know, past tactics Mossad have used for assassinations. So just to restate it, I do not think that the Israeli intelligence are involved, and I do not think this was an act of sabotage or assassination. So what I suspect is more likely to have happened, it was an unfortunate accident. And it was likely avoidable too. So President Raisi was flying in a Bell 212, and that particular model of helicopter he was flying in was over 40 years old. In fact, it might well have been in Iran during the 1979 revolution. Yeah. And it's an old helicopter which would be reliant on parts acquired via the black market or a third party, because the American government have banned sales of any aircraft parts to Iran, or at least any American-made aircraft parts to Iran. And interestingly, the F-14 Tomcat, the reason why the American government have destroyed all their Tomcats, because there aren't any in mothball, there are only now museum pieces around. They destroyed all the components because they don't want any components getting into the hands of the Iranians. And I found that out when I went to the Pima Air Space Museum in Arizona many, many years ago. It's a really great place to go, by the way, if you're into aircraft. My poor wife didn't enjoy it as much as I did, but
she took one for the team that day.
Yeah, she did, bless her. But but there we go. Then with the aviation angle as well, obviously the pilot decided to fly over a mountain in thick fog, which means they would have to be completely reliant on instruments with no visual reference at all. And it's very easy to get disorientated in thick fog. And when you're in an aircraft, you're not just dealing with, you know, forward and backwards. You can go upside down. You can do all sorts of things that are very easy to end up in if you're not paying attention to your equipment, or if you don't necessarily have the best navigational equipment, because again, we don't know what the Iranians had in that helicopter. I'm sure they probably had third-party GPS systems and stuff, but again, how reliable are those things? You're navigating, obviously, mountains, so there's heights you have to be aware of at particular points. And again, was the pilot qualified to fly in bad weather and fly in mountains? And also in mountains, you get sink effect and all sorts of things affect you from a flying point of view. So I think it's much more likely that the president crashed in this helicopter. And I think it was totally avoidable, because one part of presidential protection is not just protecting people from, you know, a would-be gunman, etc. It's also protecting the president from bad decisions. And somebody wasn't there paying attention to what was going on. And, you know, there was some sort of hubris or whatever, thinking that they could fly in this terrible weather. The weather, you know, pilots get access to weather reports. You can get weather satellite reports. So you get most pilots usually know much more about the weather than most lay people. And so I think it would be highly unlikely the pilot didn't know what he was flying into. It didn't come out as a surprise. So I think it was just stupidity or hubris who led to this. What else? So I think then this massive failure on the Iranian government's part to protect its own president, not only did they allow him to fly in an old helicopter in terrible weather, but they also couldn't locate him for hours.
Yeah.
Do they not possess transponders and emergency beacons for the president? I mean, doesn't the president even have a mobile phone? You know, he could have survived the crash potentially. I don't know the details. And he could have died due to the time it took to find him, because he would have been stuck but injured and in terrible weather up a mountain where it's going to be very cold. And literally minutes or hours can mean the difference between life and death. And so the Iranians clearly, from an institutional point of view, are not set up to protect heads of state properly. I mean, had this happened to an American president, which I don't think would have happened this way, but had it would happen, you know, rescue efforts would have located the president fairly swiftly. I don't think you'd have half this faffing about.
We never would have lost the crash site. If you know, hell freezing over, Marine One crashes, we would have real-time location of that wreckage at all times. It would never happen.
Exactly. And they wouldn't allow him to fly in such terrible conditions either. So it's so I think ultimately this all points to, and this will come up again later, this theme, I feel like the Iranian system is sort of falling apart a little bit. And I think this is a sign of that. So I don't know how you feel about it. So I'll hand it back to you.
Yeah, this is a really good points you raised there. Philip mentioned something to me yesterday that I didn't know about, but I found really interesting. So the IRGC, which in the Iranian system, maybe a little bit strong, but you could sort of compare it to like the SS, right?
Yeah.
In terms of like its own sort of quasi-political, religious, paramilitary organization that has its hands in all kinds of corporate interests and everything, but also has like its own little military and intelligence service all built into itself, right? So the IRGC has its own air force, its own navy, its own ground forces, its own intelligence service, right? And then Iran also has like a regular army. It's called the Artesh, and a regular air force, right? So this Bell transport was from the regular Iranian Air Force. There's another flight detachment. I've actually featured them in Active Measures quite a bit that transports leadership connected to the Supreme Leader's Office. They're sort of a separate thing. So I'm curious why Raisi wasn't on one of those and just on a regular Iranian Air Force helo. But anyway, so the IRGC grounded their drones in the area because they knew the weather was too bad. So it's the weather's too bad to fly unmanned drones.
Yeah, which go at a very high height. Yeah.
Right. But not bad enough that you send a helicopter through the same area with your president and your foreign minister and a couple other senior people who aren't household names to us all on board. Like, it's just like, to your point, yeah, it's totally avoidable. And yeah, it's sexy and it's interesting to be like, oh, you know, I wonder what actually happened. But this is a case where don't let malevolence speak for incompetence. Totally avoidable. And it's sort of like, you know, it's like, yeah, the helicopter was up in an area where it shouldn't have been. The weather was bad and it crashed. I mean, the very similar thing happened tragically with Kobe Bryant, you know, back in it was that early 2020. Early this year, this winter, Marine Corps Chinook crashed flying over in a mountainous area of Southern California. Same thing. You know, it happens.
We had a similar thing in 1994 with senior leaders of the intelligence services where a Chinook was flying in mountainous areas of Scotland. But I need to remind myself of what the conclusion of that was, because it was originally concluded as pilot error, but I believe actually it might have been a mechanical fault with the helicopter itself. There were quite a few that got grounded sort of afterwards, and there's been a few issues with the Chinook helicopter over the years, and in the early sort of 2000s and late 90s, if I remember correctly. But yeah,
I was really also, and on Sunday I tweeted about this a little bit, my surprise that their president and their foreign minister went down, was missing for several hours, and they couldn't locate him. And that's just really, Iran, I said this on Twitter, Iran is not some tin pot banana republic dictatorship. They're they're not 10 feet tall. They're not unstoppable, you know, but they're a fairly advanced, capable middle power, you know. They should be able to keep track of their senior leadership. Like, imagine if Iran had nuclear weapons, you know, and their president and their system is a bit different from ours. So to think of, Raisi's title is president, but it's not quite correct to think of that in the same way as a federal system like ours or a parliamentary system, right? It's a bit different. So in the situation where, let's say Iran has nuclear weapons, right? And for some reason, their president is in that chain of command, right? That would be necessary to order the launch or deployment of a nuclear weapon, right? And you have a key node in that chain of command who's just missing. You don't know where he is, you know? That's an absolute crisis moment. And that's why, like, early on in the Cold War, the U.S. government spent billions of dollars building up this infrastructure to keep track of everyone in the presidential line of succession. So Garrett Graff, a previous guest on this show, years ago, he had a book out. It's called Raven Rock. And it's all about the history of the U.S. government's continuity of government planning. You know, like, what happens in the event of a nuclear war with the Soviets? What if there's a nuclear terrorist incident, you know, an asteroid strike, a huge pandemic that kills scores of people, you know, stuff like that. Previously in the Cold War, there was a system called the FEMA Central Locator System that could have, depending on the depending on the level of like alert status that the country was on, people would be tracked more closely, you know. So rather, okay, we know the Secretary of Transportation, right? I forget what number he is offhand in the line of succession, but he is, right? Okay, the Secretary of Transportation is sitting in his home right now, okay? And under normal sort of peacetime conditions or whatever, we're fine just knowing that he's in his home, right? But let's say, okay, we move to DEFCON 2 or whatever, and there's some sort of major crisis with the Soviets looking down, like a Cuban Missile Crisis kind of situation, right? They would be able to know, okay, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Transportation got up and walked down the hallway. Like, that's how closely they would track people in the presidential line of succession in those circumstances. The program is called something different now, but essentially the same thing. The same thing exists. I once, many years ago, saw a screen in a certain room in a certain building that had like POTUS, DC, V POTUS, Wilmington, you know, and like it was a very general kind of list, but looking at that screen, you could see where all these people were. And it's just odd that, you know, Iran could, like, you know, you lost your president, your foreign minister for hours and you didn't know where it was. They needed a Turkish drone to come and help them find, and the EU's Copernicus satellite service. Yeah, pretty embarrassing moment for them, I would say.
Definitely. And allegedly, the drone that found him then drew a star and crescent on the, you could see it on the flight radar map. I'm not quite sure what the symbolism of that is, but that was an interesting little tidbit to that.
That is interesting. I'm not sure what to make of that.
Yeah.
There is reporting that, I think the State Department spokesman was asked this at a press conference and said that the Iranians asked the U.S. for assistance during the search, and the U.S. declined for, he said, logistical reasons and wouldn't go into any more than that. I mean, obviously, it would be outrageous if we had helped them, but I find it interesting that they asked. I also find it hard to believe that we wouldn't have known where Raisi crashed and that he was dead probably before the Iranians did.
Well, this is it, because it's the president of a country that daily says death to America, and it builds the entire sort of system up to destroy America and destroy Israel, and then have to turn to America for help. I think they can just go and take a flying basically.
Yeah,
I think as a diplomat, I think that's what I would have said, but yeah.
My sort of hypothetical thought on how this could have gone down, and I don't know that this happened, I haven't read anything suggesting it, but just my knowledge of the intelligence community and what we are able to do and what likely would have happened, so I could see something where this seems plausible to me. That helicopter goes missing, right? It doesn't land at the location where it was supposed to be at that time. That word then, hey, we don't know where the president is, that then filters through Iran's sort of senior leadership cadre into the IRGC, into the military, right? And somewhere along that chain gets intercepted, probably through SIGINT means. So that could be a clandestine forward listening post managed by the NSA or a remote sensor in place somewhere, perhaps somewhere in northern Iraq. I know the crash site was only 160 miles from the Iraqi border. So potential, you know, could be a satellite, could be a tap on some sort of telecommunications infrastructure somewhere, right? But so then we get notice that, okay, the Iranians don't know where Raisi is. At the same time, we have a constellation of satellites up there. It's called their DSP satellites, so the Defense Support Program. And they have these sensors on board that are designed to detect the thermal emissions, right, of a nuclear bomb going off, or a or a Scud missile launching, or let's say a bunch of surface ships for the Russian Northern Fleet, you know, fire up their engines all of a sudden and they're about to put to sea. Like, we would see that in the funnels of these ships, right, as they're powering up. Those systems apparently have gotten much more sophisticated to the extent where they could detect like a shoulder fired surface to air missile going off in a certain location, yeah, or a large fire, right? I would believe fully that one of those DSP satellites registered the heat plume from the fire after the crash, right? So if you know, okay, Raisi's missing, we know generally the location and the time where he probably went missing. Even if this didn't register in real time, it's very easy to then go back through the data for some analyst to go back through and look, okay, this part of Iran at this time, do we have anything happening? Do we see anything happening there that shouldn't be? I mean, like, the Navy heard the Titan submersible almost a year ago. We heard that pop in real time,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Same sort of different. That's under the ocean. This is, you know, up in space, but essentially the same idea behind both those systems, right? And then, okay, so we have that location fixed, right? And then you have another imagery satellite go overhead, or maybe you have a drone go up. Like I said, it's only 160 miles from the Iraqi border. And like when the Forte Global Hawks go up into the Black Sea, that's about the distance that they are from Crimea, from Russian territory or Russian held territory, right? So, okay, we can see they can at least see probably that far, right, over the border into Iran. And then you have an analyst go and look and do basically a bomb damage assessment of the wreckage and determine, okay, there's no one left alive there. And you could very easily have a very good idea that, that Raisi is dead long before the Iranians have even found the crash site. Again, I don't know that that's what happened, but knowing what we're capable of, I would be surprised if we didn't know that.
Do you or Philip have any insight on what the kind of Iranian population's reaction to this was? Because I know on Twitter there's different sort of things. There were some people who were saying open celebrations and it was all clamped down. There are others saying there was like open mourning.
Right.
And, you know, any thoughts on what the reaction was?
So Raisi's nickname was, and you touched on this in your intro a bit, Raisi's nickname was the Butcher of Tehran, and he was known for, back in the 80s and 90s, like just straight up murdering tons of dissidents, anti-regime people, right? So he was not a popular, loved man, despite what, I mean, if the IRGC, if the regime supporters want to put people out in the streets for a demonstration, they can do that. You know, they just call them up. There were big protests mourning him in Tehran, and I mean, probably all over Iran. But that's not indicative that he was, you know, loved. He wasn't at all. Philip said that his election or election/appointment by Khamenei was sort of like an FU to the rest of the population, you know, like, here, I'm going to put the Butcher of Tehran as president. Like, it's a signal that we are doubling down on our hardline ideology, right? One thing that Philip talked about was that the degree to which the Iranian militias that are backed by Iran openly sort of mourned him in ways that Philip said would probably not have been likely even several years ago. Like, it would have been a smaller closed service in Baghdad, not, you know, these like huge ceremonies and stuff like they had. He finds that interesting and sort of goes into a lot more about why and what that means and stuff in the interview.
Yeah, cool. Well, but if you haven't listened to that, do check it out. And, you know, Philip's, he's become our, I think he's probably our most featured guest now. I think he might have achieved that status. I have to double check, but I think he has. So, you know, it's great.
I think so. At least going back a couple seasons. Yeah, there hasn't been anyone on remotely that much.
I'm trying to think now. Yeah. He's got a little bit of competition, but I think he might hold the crown currently. So we are. Right, let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So we've got some comparisons between Israel and Iran on the espionage front from The Atlantic, which is a piece that you picked up.
Yes, this is a really great article in The Atlantic. It's by Kylie Moore Gilbert. She's an Australian academic focused on the Middle East. She wrote an article called "In the Game of Spy versus Spy, Israel Keeps Getting the Better of Iran." I think this is really sort of indicative of, you know, despite a lot of Iran's successes in the Middle East with the militias and stuff, they still got some serious problems. So numerous foreigners, including business people, journalists, tourists, and academics, have been unjustly convicted of espionage in Iran. Johan Floderus, hope I pronounced that correctly, a Swedish EU diplomat, currently faces severe charges and a possible death sentence on baseless accusations of spying for Israel. This is in Iran. Author of this article, as we said, is an Australian academic, was wrongfully imprisoned in Iran for over 2 years on false espionage charges. The Iranian intelligence community is marked by chaos and incompetence, often arresting innocent people while failing to capture actual spies. Their officers frequently bungle operations abroad, with recent notable failures in countries like Peru and Thailand. In contrast, Israel's intelligence operations have been highly efficient, successfully carrying out assassinations and sabotage within Iran. Mm. Many successful Israeli operations involve collaboration with local Iranian recruits, undermining the regime from within. The Iranian regime effectively suppresses domestic dissent but struggles to counter Israeli intelligence activities. Iran prioritizes loyalty over competence in its security agencies, leading to a lack of professionalism and effectiveness. Iranian intelligence officials often believe in extreme conspiracy theories, distorting their understanding and effectiveness. Iran uses intimidation and threats to coerce cooperation, contrasting with Israel's approach of offering incentives for their agents to spy for them. Many Iranians despise their regime, and some openly support Israel, advocating for stronger measures against their own government. The Iranian regime's authoritarian methods benefit Israel, providing it an upper hand in the covert intelligence war. Chris, what'd you think about this one?
Yeah, well, we've said it in the past that many Middle Eastern countries and their ruling regimes do love to claim there's an Israeli spy ring in their midst. And we pointed out, I think it was last year, with the Turkish elections, there were certain members of the opposition who were accused of being Israeli spies. And I think there was little substance to really back that up. So it doesn't surprise me that Iran likes to accuse people, especially dual nationals, of being spies for Israel and the West. There was a really interesting point in the article that came out, and I'll just quickly quote this bit. They were basically saying, "The fact that someone who has been convicted of espionage, however unjustly, was given access to such people is a testament to the chaotic way in which the intelligence work is conducted in the Islamic Republic. Indeed, although Iran's authorities talk tough and cast an extremely wide net in their quest to capture the Mossad agents they believe are in their midst, a prevailing lack of competence has meant that there are very few actual spies ever seem to be caught." And I think this sort of goes into what I was saying earlier with the death of the president. I think it kind of indicates that there's this sort of institutional rot in Iran. You know, the regime's unable to protect its own president, and it seems to be that a suspected spy somehow gets seen by many senior people, especially somebody accused on baseless charges. So it kind of feels like that they don't really know what they're doing, and they probably are getting lucky by numbers and brutality. And also the article points out about how Iranian agents have bungled operations abroad and got themselves caught. So I think ultimately, yeah, the feeling I got from this piece was that there's this sort of massive incompetence on Iran's part. And it's a dangerous incompetence, because when we talk about incompetence, people like to think that they're like Mr. Bean, some bumbling idiot who's ultimately harmless. And Iran is far from harmless. And I think a comparison to Mr. Bean is probably not very fair for Mr. Bean. But but I think sometimes, you know, I find this, I remember with, it was that film Four Lions, which is a really good film, but it's about these sort of bumbling Al-Qaeda members who tried to bomb the London Marathon, and it's a comedy. And I think a lot of people walked away with the wrong message. They kind of thought, oh, well, Islamic terrorists, they're all just bumbling idiots, are a bit harmless. It's like, well, no. These people, you know, with Ghast Al-Qaeda, ruthless, and with Iran, they're ruthless. I mean, the president was the butcher of Tehran, for crying out loud. So, yeah, so I think ultimately, like a lot of these brutal regimes, they use brutality to keep themselves in power. But really, ultimately, a lot of the brutality just covers up extreme incompetence. And I think that's sort of my theme on Iran today, is just they seem to be terribly incompetent at running things on an ordinary fashion. I don't know what other thoughts you had from the article.
Yeah, it reminds me, this article goes into a lot of great detail about the Iranians, the regimes anyway, their obsession with any of their perceived enemies, therefore, is also like an Israeli spy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I whether that's you're not acting to their appropriate moral standards, or you criticize them in any way, anything that's way short of saying, you know, I'm going to launch a quadcopter drone to blow something up on behalf of Mossad, like something way far short of that, right? It's almost like a kind of like a McCarthyism.
Yeah, totally.
You know? And it just blinds you to actual threats. To me, I see that as this whole thing as a great warning or a cautionary tale about allowing a country's security services to become so politicized by the standards of the ruling, you know, government. It just destroys you in the long run.
Yeah, I think it's a good point for 2024 with the potential politicization of American intelligence, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because usually it just ultimately
make of that what you will.
Terrible incompetence, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you, Carol.
No, that was essentially it. I also find it interesting. Kylie Moore Gilbert here says I guess her interrogators pressured her when she was in prison, pressured her quite a bit to like, hey, we'll let you go if you go back to Australia and spy on our behalf. And she said, well, like, okay, well, what if I just say okay, and then I don't do it, you know, because I'm back in Australia. And they said, you know, well, we have people there and we'll like have you killed. It's just not a very... And this is apparently a thing that they do often and widely with people that they have in their clutches. It's not a very good way to run an intelligence agent. You know, you don't want them doing this entirely under duress. Like, you don't want them, like, that's why, like, we don't, the CIA doesn't really, they don't, as a policy, they don't blackmail development targets, because they don't make good agents. You can never know if they're telling you what they think you want to hear, or if they're, you know, actually a double and trying to screw you over because you, you know, threaten their life and their family in the process. It's just not a smart way to conduct business.
No, definitely not. How would you feel, you listening out there, if somebody blackmailed you into doing something? I think once you've kind of found the new normality of this horrible situation, you'll probably find every way possible to screw your blackmailer over.
Yeah.
I think my instinct, if I was about to face years of imprisonment or torture in Iran, and they gave me the choice to go back to England as a spy, I'd say, well, yeah, hell yeah, I'm going to come and spy for you. And then I'll go straight to MI5 and say, this is what happened.
Yeah.
I need protection now. F*** you, Iran. That's kind of been my thing, I think.
Yeah. the article doesn't say anything about this, but that was my thought too. It was like, well, what if, you know, okay, you just tell Osio, can they hook you up? I don't know. I'm sure it's within their skill set to handle
We had this we had an Iranian news agency that had to leave the country now, and they were under constant 24-hour armed police protection up until I think it was about February or March this year, where in the end they concluded to it was better just to shut down their London operation and move somewhere else. But you know, so yeah, they definitely are
under threat by the regime. You're saying that's why they were under protection.
Yeah, okay. By the regime, and they were it was a suspicious individual. I think we talked about it on one of the earlier Espresso Martinis. There was a suspicious individual who was arrested for potentially scouting out for an assassination attempt. Whether or not he would be the would-be assassin, I was always unclear on, but yeah, it's isn't it? Yeah, so they do definitely have the capability, and there's certainly been a history in the past of other regimes that have bumped off political dissidents abroad and things, but they're quite rare, those kind of cases. So I still think that
it is
the Iranians are probably just playing more into fear than they would actually be able to do that, but yeah,
for the Iranians to, you know, hypothetically, let's, you know, take them at their word on this threat. For the Iranians to murder an Australian citizen in Australia, especially one who had been sort of who is a well-known figure and had been, at this point, would have been, you know, publicly released in a prisoner swap. That's a huge provocation. You know, that's just something that you just do.
No, indeed. Yeah. And I just don't think they'd better do it. I think it's just a good sort of talking point to scare people. And I think the whole reigning regime ultimately is backed up by fear. But ultimately, if somebody knew what they were doing, they could probably undermine that regime very quickly if they wanted to. So it's think that's what freaks them out. You know, when the Arab Spring kicked off, was it 2011, 2010? A lot of regimes were very disturbed by that, and ultimately, you know, if there's enough people, they could probably change things if they wanted to. It'd be interesting to sort of see what the, you know, back to Iran and the president's death and stuff, what the kind of the future holds for Iran. I mean, I don't know if you or Philip had any thoughts on where things might be heading. Are we heading for something more positive, or are we just going to have another kind of hardliner, and they would just stay in power?
I'll keep a lot of the details of this for the interview, but it does suggest it's a change in that moves the chess pieces around for what happens when Khamenei eventually goes. That's for sure. But it also suggests an eventual shift in the ruling elite of Iran from like first and second generation on from the revolution, right, to a third generation and further, and like, you know, what is the regime? What is the Islamic revolution? What is their ideology after it's passed out of living memory? You know, at least the people who were responsible for it, like who was there, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think time will tell what the future is with Iran there. We're now going to look at a piece from New York Times about some secret files that show how Hamas spy on everyday Palestinians. So I'll just go through the details. So Hamas's General Security Service, GSS, conducts extensive surveillance on Palestinians in Gaza, gathering intelligence on journalists, protesters, and individuals suspected of dissent or immoral behavior. The GSS engages in activities such as trailing journalists, removing criticism from social media, defaming political adversaries, and undermining protests which indicate a zero-tolerance policy for dissent. Gazans face dual pressures from Israel's blockade and Hamas's oppressive governance, with security forces closely monitoring and restricting their activities and expressions. The GSS operates with substantial budget and personnel dedicated to spreading propaganda and attacking opponents, functioning as a crucial part of Hamas's governance and internal security. The New York Times reviewed internal documents and interviewed individuals named in the files, confirming the GSS tactics of censorship, intimidation, and surveillance, drawing parallels to other authoritarian regimes. So, Matt, do you have any thoughts on this?
I've wanted to talk about this for a while since the article came out. It's a really interesting look at the kind of, you know, big brother surveillance state that Hamas has been running in Gaza.
Yeah.
It's a really unfortunate, you know, I think it really makes you have empathy for a lot of the people there that are just stuck in this impossible, awful situation that, you know, I think there's this sort of fantasy that like Palestinians can just reject Hamas, you know, and like go to the polling booth and, you know, cast their vote and kick these guys out, you know, like the way you guys may kick out the Tories. Not to compare the Tories to Hamas at all, but, you know, like that privilege that you have, you know, to go and cast your vote and change your government if the majority of you have decided that you want to change, you know, that's not a luxury that they have. And it just reinforces my belief that, you know, if you're a Western progressive and you hold up Hamas as a, like, instrument of class revolution and queer liberation or whatever, you either are lying or you fundamentally have no idea what you're talking about and you're being used. You're a useful idiot.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I mean, you know, I'm not alone saying this, but the Palestinians of Gaza will never be free and never prosper as long as Hamas are allowed to rule over them. They're deeply repressive and they run a brutal dictatorship, as this article has pointed out. And they, you know, the article shows very well the lengths Hamas will go to spy on its citizens and remain a dominant force. And Salman Rushdie gave a talk just recently in which he said that if the Palestinians managed to achieve an independent statehood, but with Hamas in charge, it would create a situation akin to the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So if people in the West really want to help the Palestinians achieve peace and security for themselves, they also need to be calling out Hamas alongside calling out Israel for its excessive force. So, you know, and there's a quote in here that sort of says it all, really, which is from one of the people they interviewed, a man named Ihab Fasfu, who was a journalist in the Gaza Strip. And he said that we're facing bombardment by the occupation and thuggery by the local authorities. And that, I think, is the situation on the ground in Gaza at the moment. The Palestinians of Gaza are between a rock and a hard place, and Hamas will not tolerate any dissent, hence why there's been no elections since they got into power. They kind of basically, Hamas managed to use the democratic process to then end the democratic process, which is, you know, something kind of fascists and dictatorships like to do. And like you were just saying just moments ago, you know, we do... I think sometimes people do take their right to vote for granted. This is the kind of alternative to democracy, and it's not great. And I think people in the West really, you know, need to be calling out Hamas, because there will never be peace as long as they're in power. You know, as we said, you know, just a few days after October the 7th, we did quite a big piece on Hamas and their genocidal intent towards Israeli citizens, and it's a stated fact, it's in their charter. And so there will never be peace as long as you've got Hamas in charge and they're, you know, wanting to regroup and commit another atrocity like October the 7th. And then Israel will then respond again with their full might, like they've done, and kill many innocent people like they have done. And this cycle of violence will kind of continue as long as people in the West keep providing flak for Hamas and members. And also, I'm going to call out member states, the UN as well, because frequently they don't call out Hamas either. They spend most of their time criticizing Israel. And I get it. Israel does need to be held to account also for its excessive force, or from what I see and feel as excessive force. Mm-hmm. Thousands of civilians have been killed. I don't know the exact figures, because
40,000.
Because we can't. Yeah, because Hamas run the health ministry, it's difficult to get an exact figure, but it's definitely, without a doubt, going to be somewhere around that 40,000 figure. It may be, you know, 5,000 above that or 5,000 below it, but that's a lot of people, a lot of people who've lost relatives, etc. Right, I think we will wrap up there. Unfortunately, not the cheeriest of notes to finish on. Matt, thank you very much for your time today. We are now going to move over to Extra Shot, which is our show for Patreon subscribers. If you want to get access to Extra Shot, all you need to do is click on the link in the show notes or go to patreon.com/secretsandspies. We're going to be looking at Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who apparently has not been taking the work of his intelligence services seriously. We're also going to be looking at some Chinese research into brain-computer interfaces is getting into the creepy territory.
Yeah, this is real nightmare fuel stuff
here. Okay, it's a funny territory there. And then we're going to be looking at the FBI cutting ties of Russian informants. And then we'll probably wrap up with a look at the CIA funding of artworks during the Cold War. So just click on the link in the show notes and you'll get access to Extra Shot and whichever level you choose to subscribe at. You get either a free coaster or coffee cup. And before we go, don't forget you can connect with us on social media. Just go to @secretsandspies on Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. I will say on Twitter, It's Secrets and Spies, but spelled S-P-I-E-S, not S-P-Y-S, because there is another account with a similar name, but that's not us. And if you can...
And they spell it
wrong.
I know,
they do. But if you're in doubt, again, go to the show notes, and you can click on the link there, and it will take you to it. So on that note, we will see you on Extra Shot. And if we don't, have a great weekend, and thank you very much for listening. Take care.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.